So back in 1965, the executives at this utility company, Southern California Edison, they put together what they believed was this, flawless, purely data-driven 5-year plan.
Right. Yeah. And at the time, they were really seen as the absolute gold standard for technical forecasting in the industry.
Exactly. They just fed all their historical electricity usage into the most sophisticated models of the era, plotted a line on the graph, and figured, well, our future revenue is completely locked in.
Which, of course, is exactly when the massive Northeast blackout hit.
Yeah. The power grid just completely failed. And suddenly, consumer expectations around reliability changed literally overnight, making that mathematically pristine plan totally worthless.
It's just such a classic cautionary tale about the illusion of control,
Yeah.
really. I mean, we all desperately want the future to be quantifiable, but the strategic landscape of global markets is just fundamentally unknowable.
And that tension between our desire for predictable certainty and the chaotic reality of the world, that is exactly what we're unpacking in today's deep dive.
Because today we are looking at a massive, systematic literature review. It's essentially a meta-analysis that synthesizes 50 years of research on corporate foresight.
Right, 50 years of data from the journal Technological Forecasting and Social Change. We are talking a journey into how the smartest minds in business and academia have tried to solve this exact paradox.
The scope of this review is just staggering, honestly. The authors started by combing through over 800 articles published between 1969 and 2018.
Wow, that is a mountain of data.
It really is. And they systematically narrowed it down to the 32 most highly cited influential papers. What they created is basically a map tracking the intellectual evolution of an entire field.
And our mission today is to follow that map. We're going to see exactly how corporate foresight evolved from those futile attempts to perfectly predict the future into building agile organizations that can actually adapt to multiple possible futures.
Exactly. It's a massive shift in organizational thinking.
So whether you are trying to future-proof your own career, steer a startup, or just understand how massive conglomerates navigate chaos, this deep dive is going to give you the ultimate shortcut to 50 years of strategic wisdom. So let's unpack this.
Well, before we jump into the timeline, we really need to establish what this research actually defines as corporate foresight.
Because it's not just, gazing into a crystal ball to guess what year a specific gadget is going to be invented.
Right, no. The authors make it explicitly clear that foresight is a three-step process. First, identifying factors of change, then interpreting the organization-specific implications, and most crucially, triggering an appropriate organizational response.
And that third step, triggering the response, that really feels like the linchpin.
Oh, absolutely. If an organization just stops at step two, foresight is completely useless. It's just a purely intellectual exercise.
Like, simply knowing a major market disruption is coming doesn't help you at all if your company does absolutely nothing to prepare for it.
Yeah, the defining characteristic of successful corporate foresight is taking external observations of the changing world and actually using them to drive internal transformation.
It kind of reminds me of advanced weather forecasting for a ship captain.
Oh, I like that, yeah.
Right. You aren't just looking at the radar for the fun of guessing if it's going to rain. You're using that radar to make immediate, tangible decisions.
Like whether you need to reroute the ship entirely.
Exactly. Do you need to tie down the cargo? Or, hey, can you actually capture those storm winds in your sails to move faster than your competitors?
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And, if we look back at the early days of corporate planning, companies genuinely believed their only job was just to predict the weather perfectly.
Which brings us back to Southern California Edison and the failures of the 1970s and 80s. If the ultimate goal is to trigger a response, how did early corporations actually try to manage this?
Well, early on in the 70s, scientists and technicians were producing these incredibly detailed technological forecasts. They would project exactly when a new type of machine or manufacturing process would be available.
But let me guess, the actual management planners were essentially ignoring them.
Precisely. Authors like William Swager identified this massive disconnect. The technologists were forecasting technology for the sake of technology, totally decoupled from what the market actually needed.
So the radar's on, but the captain isn't even looking at the screen.
Yeah, exactly. So researchers started arguing that forecasting needed to start with future market needs rather than just technology production. But even when they shifted to the market, they were still relying on linear prediction.
Meaning they believed past trends would neatly continue into the future. Which brings us back to that Edison case study from the 1980s.
Right. And they didn't stop with that 1965 failure. They made a 1970 plan, which then completely imploded because of sudden anti-nuclear protests and the OPEC oil embargo.
And what blows my mind is their initial reaction to those massive failures.
They doubled down. They literally assumed their math just wasn't good enough.
Yeah, they poured resources into gathering more data, building more elaborate models, buying better computers.
They believed that if they just crunched the numbers hard enough, they'd find the hidden pattern.
But you cannot mathematically extrapolate an unprecedented event like the OPEC oil embargo from historical electricity usage data. It's just impossible.
Right, and they eventually had to accept that painful realization. The problem wasn't a lack of data. The problem was that certain events are discontinuities.
They break the linear trend completely.
Exactly. Past data simply does not hold up in unstable times. Uncertainty isn't a math error you can fix with a better algorithm. It is an irreducible fact of reality.
Okay, wait, let me push back here for a second.
Sure, go for it.
If Southern California Edison proved definitively back in the 1980s that pouring more data into elaborate models couldn't predict massive societal shifts, why are modern CEOs still obsessed with pouring billions into AI predictive models today? Are we just completely ignoring business history?
Well, we are fighting against human psychology. Humans have a cognitive limitation that researchers call bounded rationality.
Bounded rationality. What does that mean in this context?
It means our brains literally cannot hold 50 different fluctuating market variables at once without melting down. We crave simplicity.
Ah, so a predictive algorithm gives an executive a single number, a single definitive path forward.
Yes. It feels safe to take that to the board of directors.
Mm.
But relying on a single predictive algorithm when dealing with true market chaos is what the literature describes as gambling with history.
Because it leaves the company incredibly fragile.
Exactly. So Edison eventually proved that rigid prediction fails. But just throwing your hands up and accepting uncertainty doesn't tell a company what products to actually build tomorrow.
Right. So how did organizations bridge that gap?
Well, by the 1990s, Western companies were losing massive market share to Japanese firms. And researchers realized those Japanese firms were succeeding because they had implemented industry foresight techniques a decade earlier.
Which sparked a huge focus on something called strategic scanning.
Exactly. The review highlights Rias van Wyk's concept of a 360-degree orientation.
The argument being that companies needed to look far ahead at the horizon rather than just keeping abreast of whatever their immediate competitors were doing, right?
Yes. And to actually execute this, they introduced a fascinating matrix approach. The idea is to combine a firm's internal core competencies with external landmark technologies.
And a landmark technology is like a fundamental evolutionary step forward in science or engineering.
Right. And the paper uses the Danish electronics firm Bang & Olufsen as a great example to illustrate this.
Yeah, so imagine drawing a massive grid. On the vertical axis, you list out the things your company is already world-class at your core competencies. For an electronics firm, that might be acoustics or image processing or the human device interface.
That forms your foundation. Then across the horizontal axis, you list emerging landmark technologies that are just starting to appear on the horizon. Things like diamond thin films, super magnets, or magnetic levitation.
And the real magic happens in the intersecting boxes.
Right. The matrix physically forces a structured, highly specific conversation about the future. You point to a box and ask your team, well, how could magnetic levitation completely revolutionize our acoustic interface?
It takes this vague concept of the future and anchors it directly to the company's internal capabilities.
Exactly. And that desire to visualize the future directly paved the way for the obsession of the 2000s, which was technology road mapping.
Robert Fales' framework, right?
Yes. A roadmap is a visual temporal map that charts out the simultaneous relationships between evolving markets, evolving products, and evolving technologies over time.
Which seems absolutely crucial for actually getting anything built. Because
yeah.
Without a timeline, I imagine companies just get trapped in short-term thinking.
Oh, totally. If a manager is only judged on next quarter's return on investment, they're only going to fund safe, boring, incremental updates.
Right. But road mapping gave companies the permission to step back and invest in long-term technological trajectories. But to me, the truly revolutionary thing about a roadmap isn't the chart itself.
It's the shift in organizational psychology.
Exactly. In academic terms, the review says a roadmap acts as a boundary object.
Yeah.
So let's define that. What is a boundary object in plain English?
Think about the classic corporate divide. For decades, the R&D department and the marketing department spoke entirely different languages.
R&D wants to build flying cars just to see if they can, while marketing is desperately trying to sell bicycles today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A boundary object is a tool that allows different departments to finally communicate.
It's like a corporate Rosetta Stone.
That is a brilliant way to put it. The roadmap forces the engineers, the senior management, and the commercial teams to look at the exact same document.
It translates the R&D timeline into a language the commercial team actually understands.
Right. Marketing stops promising products that don't exist yet, and R&D stops building technologies that don't have a future market application. They agree on a shared reality.
It's like playing a multi-layered game of chess where the board itself is evolving. You aren't just moving pieces, you're coordinating with your team to anticipate if the board is going to suddenly turn into a checkerboard.
Or a go board, yeah.
Exactly. But looking at the literature from the 2010s to today, the research introduces a new problem. Roadmaps are incredible for aligning a team, but what happens when the external environment becomes so wildly complex and fast-moving that a 10-year roadmap is outdated the second it leaves the printer?
Right, the board is changing too fast to map it. So the most recent era of foresight research shifts entirely. It moves away from building static maps and focuses instead on building organizations that are culturally and structurally adaptive.
Foresight becomes less of a separate department and more of an integrated corporate function.
Yes. There is a fantastic breakdown of how foresight plays three distinct roles within a company to drive innovation. First is the strategist.
Which is foresight guiding the overall direction of the company, maybe repositioning the entire product portfolio based on long-term trends.
Right. The second role is the initiator. This is foresight acting as an active scout. They are out in the field identifying entirely new customer needs and feeding those raw ideas into the front end of the innovation pipeline.
And the third, which sounds like the most difficult, is the opponent.
Oh, definitely. The opponent acts as a challenger to the company's own legacy assumptions. They look at the company's most profitable, beloved product and ask, how is a competitor going to destroy this?
It's designed to aggressively prevent complacency.
Exactly.
But surely a massive global energy conglomerate doesn't plan for the future using the exact same tools as a consumer electronics manufacturer. I mean, you can't just be an adaptive scout if you are building a $1 billion oil rig.
And you just hit on one of the most vital insights in the entire 50-year review. There is a groundbreaking study from 2012 by a researcher named Vecchiato that examined how companies like Royal Dutch Shell, BASF, Nokia, and Philips operate. He distinguished between two fundamentally different types of uncertainty, complexity and dynamism.
Let's slow down and really pull those two apart because this feels like the crucial aha moment of the research.
Let's start with complexity. Shell and the chemical company BASF operate in environments of extreme, deep-rooted complexity. They are dealing with massive capital investments building offshore platforms or chemical refineries.
Where you have to commit billions of dollars up front and you won't see a return on that investment for 20 years.
Exactly. You cannot build an oil rig using a quick, agile pivot. Once the concrete is poured, you are committed.
Right.
Because of that massive capital lock-in, companies facing complexity require deep 15 to 20-year scenario planning. They need to map out heavily researched narratives about macroeconomics, geopolitics, and global energy demands.
To manage all those intertwined variables. But then you look at Philips and Nokia in the consumer electronics and mobile markets, their environment isn't defined by 20-year capital lock-ins.
No, it is defined by extreme dynamism. The market changes at breakneck speed. Consumer values shift overnight, and a product life cycle might only be 18 months.
So a 20-year PDF scenario plan is completely useless for a smartphone manufacturer. They don't have the luxury of time.
Exactly. So instead, companies facing dynamism use quick, flexible 5 to 10-year probes.
What does a probe actually look like in practice?
It looks like an active experiment. Instead of writing a report about what consumers might want in 5 years, Philips would quickly build a rough prototype, launch it into a targeted test market, and measure the real-world reaction.
They use the product itself as a scout to gather intelligence on shifting consumer values.
Right. The core lesson is that you must match your foresight tool to the specific type of uncertainty your industry faces.
And as we move into environments where complexity and dynamism overlap, the methods have to get even more advanced. The review details a framework called Robust Decision Making, or RDM.
Yes. There is an incredible study looking at how the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California used RDM to plan their water infrastructure around climate change.
Because climate change is the ultimate unpredictable variable. You have wildly diverging models on rainfall, temperature spikes, population shifts.
And if you build a dam based on the wrong climate model, millions of people run out of water.
So instead of trying to find one optimal plan based on a single forecast of what the climate might do, they ran massive computer simulations.
Right. They generated thousands of distinct, plausible futures. And then they literally stress-tested their policy options against all of them.
Imagine tweaking the dials on a computer model. What happens to this infrastructure plan if rainfall drops by 20%, but the population simultaneously surges by 30%?
A fragile plan snaps immediately under that pressure.
But wait, let me push back here. If an executive team generates thousands of distinct futures, doesn't that just cause paralyzing information overload? We literally just established that human brains melt down with too many variables.
It's a great point.
How does an organization look at thousands of scenarios and actually make a decision without freezing up?
It requires a fundamental shift in how we define a good decision. RDM completely changes the goal. The traditional approach is searching for the mathematically optimal plan.
You want the path that generates the absolute highest return on investment.
Assuming your specific forecast is correct, yes. But optimality is incredibly fragile. If the future deviates even slightly from your guess, your optimal plan goes bankrupt.
So what replaces optimality?
Robustness. You use the simulation algorithms to sort through those thousands of futures looking for vulnerabilities. You're searching for the specific policies that survive, or at least perform adequately, across the widest possible range of scenarios.
Ah, so it's not about winning the game with the highest possible score. It's about making absolutely sure you never get knocked out of the tournament, no matter what curveballs the future throws.
It is a strategy of pure resilience. A robust plan might only get you a B+ in the best case scenario, but it prevents you from failing completely in the worst-case scenario.
You iterate the plan, finding its breaking points in the simulation, and adjusting until your strategy is robust against almost anything.
Exactly.
So seeing how far we have come from the rigid predictions of the 1960s, what does this review say about the gaps in the research? Where does the field of corporate foresight go from here?
Unsurprisingly, the largest unexplored frontier is the intersection of artificial intelligence and big data with human insight.
Because we finally have the processing power to analyze global trends in real time.
Right, but the challenge is ensuring we use AI correctly.
We don't want to just use AI to build a slightly faster version of the flawed 1965 prediction model.
Exactly. The goal isn't just feeding more data into the machine to get a single comforting number. The hope is that AI can be used to actively challenge human blind spots.
It can process the overwhelming variables that cause our bounded rationality to fail.
Yes, presenting us with diverse scenarios rather than just amplifying our biases by showing us what we want to see.
The review also points heavily toward a future of networked or open foresight. We are realizing that the future isn't just about one single company planning its strategy in a silo behind closed doors.
When you look at the massive societal challenges on the horizon, global supply chain fragility, rapid technological disruption, climate adaptation, no single corporation can navigate those alone.
So the research suggests the future belongs to collaborative foresight.
Exactly. Multiple organizations, even competitors, sharing intelligence and building entire innovation ecosystems to tackle systemic uncertainty together. Moving toward real-time decision-making, where foresight platforms act as virtual collaborative systems.
Bringing this deep dive full circle, this 50-year systematic review really paints a remarkable picture of intellectual evolution.
It really does.
We started in the 1960s and 70s with this profound hubris. We possessed the arrogant belief that if we just gathered enough historical data and built a sharp enough math model, we could perfectly predict the actions of a chaotic world.
And we learned, through painful, costly failures, that we cannot bend the future to our spreadsheets.
We have moved to a much more humble, but ultimately far more powerful realization. Foresight is not about prediction at all. It is about building an adaptive learning organization.
It is the hard work of translating external signals into internal resilience.
Yeah.
If there is one memorable insight from this entire meta-analysis, it is that corporate foresight is not a crystal ball. It is the micro foundation of organizational survival.
But you have to know what kind of game you are playing.
Right. You must match your foresight tools to the type of uncertainty you face. A global conglomerate facing deep complexity needs the 20-year scenario plan. A tech startup facing rapid dynamism needs the fast exploratory probes.
And the beautiful thing is that this logic directly applies to you, the listener. You don't have to be running a massive corporation to use these tools. You can apply the concept of robust decision-making to your own life and your own career. Stop trying to perfectly optimize your skills for one specific future scenario that may never actually arrive. Instead, focus on building a robust portfolio of skills, relationships, and adaptability that will keep you in the tournament across multiple possible futures.
You want to be the captain who can pivot. You want the ability to use those unexpected storm winds to your advantage, no matter which direction they happen to blow.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. According to the researchers behind this massive review, organizations are, at their core, interpretation systems.
Mm-hmm.
They take in messy data from the outside world, they attempt to make sense of it, and then they act. So look at your own organization, your own team, or even your own personal strategy. What kind of sensors do you currently have turned on?
Are you only using your radar to stare at the immediate road ahead?
Obsessing over the next quarter? Or are you actually scanning the horizon, looking for the discontinuities that change everything?
Because the storm is definitely out there. It's just a matter of whether you have built the capacity to see it in time, translate what it means, and actually adjust your sails.